ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country, sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. This is The Law Report on ABC Radio National. When a natural disaster strikes your home, what are your legal rights?
Victoria has faced its worst bushfires since Black Summer in 2019-2020.
In Victoria, where several emergency level fires are continuing to burn across
since
the state.
Fires whipped through the Drysdale family's central Victorian property, there's barely been time to pause. Their house in smouldering ruins.
Bushfires continue to rage in parts of Victoria. In other areas, the flames have been extinguished and communities are beginning to ask, what's next?
There's some issues in some of the businesses with who had the contents insurance, or perhaps neither party had contents insurance.
Last Friday, I travelled to the town of Castlemaine, 100 kilometres north of Melbourne, to visit the town's fire recovery centre. Today, I'm in the town of Castlemaine, just 10 kilometres from the bushfire-devastated township of Harcourt. I'm sitting here at the Castlemaine Community House with Rebecca Edwards. She's Director of Legal Practice with ARC, which is the community legal centre which serves communities across northern and central Victoria. And she's also a resident of Harcourt, which was pretty much destroyed by fire a little over a week ago. Rebecca, what's been the damage in your community?
There's approximately 50 houses that have been destroyed. There's also a significant business loss, particularly around the Harcourt Cool Store and a cafe that's also been destroyed as part of that complex. And then there's a number of farms, including our own, that have been impacted, and lots of people whose houses have been saved have still lost things like sheds and pastures and fences and what have you.
And how's your community, how are your friends and neighbours doing?
It's been amazing how the community has pulled together. People are up and down, is what I've found. So, you know, they're really good one day, and the next day they're having a bit of a down day. But the support that's come through both locally and more widely is just overwhelming. It's incredible.
And people have lost their homes. That must have a massive impact on them.
Yeah, but even some of them are out volunteering at the community hub and serving food for other people. You know, people have amazing resilience a lot of the time, but also there's tears and sadness. Obviously, a lot of the people who lost their homes are not necessarily in Harcourt right now because they have got temporary accommodation elsewhere. So perhaps most of the people I'm seeing are people whose homes are still there.
What was the impact on your property?
We've got a farm of about 93 acres. The house has survived, but the historic apple packing shed on the property completely burnt and all its contents. A lot of farm machinery went, and pretty much all of our pastures and fences have gone. We've also got a lot of absolutely beautiful old trees in one of the back paddocks, like hundreds and hundreds of years old, and a lot of them have unfortunately been impacted too.
I mean, have you been speaking with your friends and neighbours about legal issues? I mean, I know you're a member of the community, but you're also a lawyer. Have you started those conversations?
It's pretty early days, I think, so far for legal issues. There is a little bit of concern about insurance already, but I haven't heard any bad stories yet. I've just heard that there are some offers being made that maybe are not like fully assessed yet. There's also, you know, all those discussions about what's insured and what's not insured. I know that there's some issues in some of the businesses with who had the contents insurance, or perhaps neither party had contents insurance, and everybody's being very amiable and supportive at the moment, but there may be some issues that come up there. I've also heard of situations where people had stuff stored at other people's houses, and that's the same sort of issue. Who actually covers that loss when it maybe doesn't belong to the homeowner.
Have you put in an insurance claim yet for your losses?
Yeah, the insurer actually contacted us directly and effectively put in the claim for us, and they're coming later today to have a look at it. But we are only minimally insured for what we've lost, which was, I guess, an active choice based on the cost. You know, insurance for fences is incredibly expensive. So we're not insured for the fences, which is probably the biggest financial impact on us.
So you had presumably house and contents insurance, but thank goodness the house is okay. But you maybe don't have insurance for the shed or the equipment and the fences on your property, which have gone up in smoke.
Yeah, and a lot of the bits of farming equipment are quite useful to us. Things like spray tanks and like a 300 litre petrol pump that we use to fill up the tractor and things like that. But the excess on each of those individual items is sort of, you know, close to the equivalent of what their value is. So that's a bit of a toss-up about what you do there.
Rebecca, what's been coming up in conversations with your friends and your neighbours in Harcourt about possible insurance issues that are going to arise?
So I know one of the issues with some of the businesses is that perhaps the owner of the building didn't have contents insurance, but also the business that stored stuff in the building didn't have contents insurance because they didn't own the building. So there's issues about whether they just wear the loss or what's going to happen. I mean, it's really early days and nobody's pointing fingers or blaming anybody, but there's a fact that a lot of businesses are going to have to make some strategic decisions about where they go legally or what action they take, or whether they just wear those losses and accept the fact that the community as a whole has been impacted and just share that tragedy, I guess.
At what stage is the recovery? Are people allowed back into the Harcourt area? Are the rules around access clear?
No, I would say they're not particularly clear, and I'm not blaming anyone for that. I think officially you're not supposed to be in Harcourt, but in reality there's a whole lot of people who are in Harcourt and have been right through the fires or who came back very early on, including ourselves. There are roadblocks up, but they don't always have a person there, so people are driving around them. And some businesses are getting in, some aren't getting in. It's a bit unclear whether it's okay to ask your friend to come and help you do some clean-up or not, because are they allowed in or are they not? Yeah, like I said, I think strictly speaking, nobody's really supposed to be in there, but that's not the reality of the situation.
And you mentioned earlier that the insurance companies have been proactively contacting people. Is that a good thing?
I think it probably is, because people are all aware that you need to put in an insurance claim. I guess it's just as long as they're not rushing to finalise them too quickly.
And what's the danger there?
That you might not have fully appreciated what your loss is. So even for us, you know, one... We didn't realise there was one item that we hadn't mentioned that we've now realised has burnt. And we're, you know, just a little loss compared to if you'd lost your whole house. There'd be so many things in there that you'd have to be thinking about.
Have you been attending community meetings in Harcourt? And what issues have been raised at those meetings, which have maybe a legal or a regulatory dimension?
There haven't been any community meetings in Harcourt itself. There's been community gatherings for lunch, but there hasn't been any sort of formal component to them. They've really just been a chance for people to get together. Yesterday at the Harcourt Community Hub, there were a number of people from council there. There was talk about, you know, some things that can benefit the community both now in our real urgent time of need, but also longer term down the track. I mean, there's so much like emergency relief right at the moment in terms of food and bathroom supplies and all that sort of stuff. So that's there. Housing's going to be a big issue. Housing was already so incredibly fraught in the whole of Victoria, but certainly in this area too. So a lot of the families that were impacted were renters, but even if they weren't, they're going to be now temporarily. And even if they have insurance to pay for that, where's the property going to be? I don't know.
Rebecca, look, thank you for talking to me at is a very difficult time for you and your community, so thank you.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
I'm now speaking with Jack Piper. He's an outreach worker and the climate justice lead with ARC Justice, the Bendigo-based community legal centre, which serves communities across northern and central Victoria. And he is a Castlemaine local. Jack, we've just been on a walk around the Castlemaine Recovery Hub, which has been set up in response to the very serious fire in Harcourt, which is only about 10 kilometres away from here. The town hall's very busy and it's filled with tables and chairs and various organisations which are there to offer assistance. Walk me through who was there. There were a range of people.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different services all in one place. So people can come in as a kind of one-stop shop. So we've got the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing from the Victorian Government and Services Australia from the Federal Government to support people with their applying for grants and disaster relief payments. We've got kind of health and mental health services. So a lot of psychosocial support, housing support, food relief. I mean, Vic Roads is there to help people replace their licences. We've got financial counselling services, a business help desk from the local council, Mount Alexander. Agriculture Victoria's there, as well as all the major insurers are also have a presence.
Who's been coming and talking to you? Can you tell me what they've been asking?
I mean, the big thing is that disasters like fires here in Alexander, they create new legal issues for people, and they range. I mean, some of them are more easily linked to the disaster itself. So, for example, you know, tenancy evictions, in which case they should seek legal advice before handing over their keys, absolutely. Insurance is, of course, a big one. We're hearing a number of people are underinsured and, you know, we're expecting that might be a common story. That means they'll have to take cash settlements, and we're really strongly encouraging people to get advice before accepting any cash settlement offer. In these early days, one of the things we're hearing is insurers offering temporary accommodation payments that are less than what the person is eligible or entitled to. So we're also encouraging people to get advice on any of those payments before accepting an offer. The thing is that disasters like this don't just create new legal needs, they also compound or make existing legal issues more complicated.
And I suppose the great thing about having everybody in the emergency hub centre here is that you talk to one person and then in the course of that conversation, you realise that they should actually go talk to ARC Justice the next table along. Have you had any situations like that?
Yeah, I might just talk generally rather than giving specific stories, but absolutely the benefit of being in the hub with all these other services is not just to have the presence and to support people, but actually have the close relationships with the other service providers so that we can do that literacy building around legal issues to keep an eye out for and make sure that everyone knows that free legal support is available. For example, you know, if someone comes in and they've left their glasses in the house and they connect with the local health service and they set up an optometry appointment for them. In the conversation, they might find out and hear that they've actually got a couple of legal issues that the individual might not have considered a legal issue, and then can connect us two tables over and then we're able to help that person.
And maybe if you're having a conversation with somebody and they do seem pretty stressed, you can refer them on to, you know, maybe the mental health people or the support people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we're talking to people, there's sometimes issues with short-term accommodation, and we can connect them with the right person. Psychosocial support is a big one. There's an amazing team down in the hub. Financial counselling is a really important referral pathway for us. When people come to us with, you know, debt or insurance issues, we can support them through some of the legal aspects and some of the claims process and any disputes, and the financial counsellors are there as well, so we work really closely with them, and that's a long-standing relationship, particularly in this area with the Anglicare financial counselling team, who were present with us in the hubs after the 2022 floods up in our catchment as well.
Okay, Jack, well, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks for having me, Damien.
I'm now talking with Bronwyn Lay. She's the program manager with Disaster Legal Help Victoria. Bronwyn, tell me, what is that organisation?
Disaster Legal Help Victoria is a partnership, a public and private partnership across the whole legal sector. Our partners include the Law Institute of Victoria, the Victorian Bar, Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service, Justice Connect, Federation of Community Legal Centres and Victoria Legal Aid. And so we resource and provide free legal assistance for Victorians impacted by disasters. It's got a local first principle. So ARC is the local service on the ground that's responding to community, and we link them in with any services that they then need for pro bono or expert assistance.
Bronwyn, I've been hearing about the issue of lack of insurance or under insurance. It's a real issue for people going forward, but it's also a real issue in the heat of the moment of a bushfire or a flood, isn't it? Because people are making decisions in the moment based on their insurance status.
I think that that is a real risk that people are facing. And sometimes people are facing that decision really quickly and their insurance may have lapsed. They may have chosen not to renew it because of cost. And then they're uninsured when a hazard occurs or a fire occurs. And then because all of their lives are in that home, they make the decision to stay and defend. And that's a risk to life. Mm. So yes, down the stream of being uninsured are other decisions that people make.
So there are questions around, you know, people choosing to stay or to leave, but there are also around questions around whether they can still be in an area. There are evacuation orders, there are closed roads, those sorts of things. Well, what are some of the legal issues there?
Well, some of the legal issues stem from when people are stuck in a road and they're going down a road and they don't know whether a park ranger or another official can tell them whether they should be leaving or should not. So that's what happened in Gippsland in the 2019 and 2020 fires. There was a lot of community confusion about whether they could be told to leave and by whom. There was also confusion around whether they, what happens when they stay. So that's why we put together some community legal education. So community could make those decisions themselves, but make sure that they were making them within the law and they weren't going against the law. So when Victorians have a pecuniary interest, which means a financial interest in a property, that means that they are able to stay. So, and that has ramifications in terms of whether they defend their property or also in relation to emergency management kind of strategy around that, who chooses to stay.
That raises real questions of risk, both for the people but also for the emergency services.
That's why it's really important for community to know the law around that so that they can have preparatory conversations with their local emergency management, such as the CFA, and say, I'm choosing to stay and defend, and it's on this basis. And so preparations can be done if that's going to occur.
And are those sorts of issues also alive after a fire has been through? I mean, right now in the immediate aftermath of the fire?
Yeah, and it's the right of return. And so while people do have, if they have a proprietary interest in a property, can stay. However, the right of return is determined by emergency management, and there is law around that. And so it has to be determined safe. You can't just, as an individual, go back. So this is where it arose, is that people were trying to get back into their properties in Black Summer, and I'm sure this is happening with every hazard or disaster.
It's happening right now.
Yeah, and they weren't sure who was telling them whether they couldn't. That was really confusing. And you can't automatically go back to your property. So it's very different to the right to stay. The right to return is really quite strict in order for public safety to be secured.
Bronwyn Lay, Program Manager from Disaster Legal Help Victoria, thank you.
Thank you, Damien.
So I'm here in Castlemaine Community House with Damien Stock. He's a lawyer and CEO of ARC Justice. That's the Community Legal Centre, which serves communities across northern and central Victoria. And of course, we've just been hearing from Rebecca Edwards, which is one of his colleagues at the legal service. Damien, as we were walking into this interview room, we walked past a food distribution centre. So everybody across the region is kind of, you know, coming together to try and support the people who've, lost their homes in the fires. So everyone's pulling together, aren't they?
Yes, we know there's obviously a huge role for the state government and local governments, but it's been wonderful to see the local community really wrap its arms around those who've been impacted. And where we are here is really a major distribution point for people who have donated food and other material goods.
And Damien, look, in my conversations with Rebecca, she raised a number of kind of legal issues which arise following a fire. Let's start with tenancy. What happens if a property is destroyed and there are tenants living in that property?
Yeah, so the first thing to note is it's very early days after the fires. What we see in terms of the priority legal issues immediately, it's often it is often tenancy, and then it's insurance, often it's access to payment, social security, and maybe employment law. But particularly on residential tenancies, if a property is uninhabitable, it can be ended, the lease can be ended by either the renter or the rental provider. In fires, it's a lot more obvious that the property is uninhabitable. It's very different from floods, where it might be a repair issue on behalf of the landlord who has the obligation to repair it. We're really concerned to be speaking with renters in the first instance so that they don't just hand their keys back thinking that they don't have rights if the property's been partially damaged. We really want to assess for them whether it's an obligation on the landlord to be fixing the property or whether the property is indeed uninhabitable and how they can go about ending their lease.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? Because if a property is damaged but not completely destroyed, that does raise issues for both the rental provider and the tenant. You know, obviously the tenant will want to maybe stay, but the rental provider might not be in a position to fix the property immediately.
Yeah, so following the October 22 floods, we've been speaking with the Victorian government around reforms that are necessary to the Residential Tenancies Act to really to provide solutions for this disaster situation. Because you're exactly right, often the property ought to be repaired, the obligations on the landlord, but we know access to tradespeople during disasters is pretty limited. There's no obligation on the landlord to provide alternate accommodation. There's going to be a period of time before the property is going to be fixed. At the moment, as it stands, the Residential Tenancies Act says if the property is habitable, the obligation's on the landlord to repair it. If it's uninhabitable, either party can end the lease. So it's very one or the other, I suppose, at the moment, which we say from a policy position is really ill-fitted to properties being damaged through particularly floods, but also partially damaged through fires as well.
And what about accessing a property which is damaged? Is that to recover possessions? Is that sometimes an issue as well for renters in fires and in floods?
Yes, it certainly is. Whether you're a homeowner or a renter, I think accessing a property is an issue, and people are obliged to follow the emergency instructions to try and keep them safe. We've heard from emergency services this week that more harm is done to emergency services people and occupants from falling limbs and trees often than the fire or the disaster itself. So there's a real need for people to stay away and to take the direction of emergency services. But of course, people want to access their properties. They want to assess the damage and they want to recover their goods. There's no one answer to that.
What about insurance issues? Rebecca also said, look, some of the insurance companies have been approaching her and her neighbours and friends, so that's a great thing, isn't it?
We're starting to see a shift on the part of some insurers, certainly not all of them, to be more proactive following a disaster. It makes a world of difference to have the insurance companies turn up to the recovery hubs and be accessible for people who want to lodge a claim. It's great to have the insurance council there. It's really important to have organisations like ours there and other community legal services and financial counsellors. If we can have both the advocates and supporters as well as the insurance companies on site, we think that's the best trauma-informed response to people who are about to make a claim. I think it's important to remember that this is often, the worst day in people's lives. They're not experienced with how to respond to a disaster. They might never have filed an insurance claim before. So we just want people to be seeking advice before taking any steps with their insurance company.
And Rebecca says the risk of accepting a cash settlement for your insurance claim is that your damages have not been properly assessed and quantified. That's the issue here.
Absolutely. And cash settlements, how do you assess what the real cost is going to be to rebuild? Are you taking into account the delay through accessing tradespeople? In the floods of 22, it was also just the provision of materials to rebuild. It's impossible, we would say, in the very early days to really understand the full cost of the damage to your property. So we would discourage people from accepting cash settlements in the early days and seeking advice from a financial counsellor or a legal service before doing so. There's no need to rush. We understand that people want access to payments. There are emergency payments available, and so we encourage people to take those up first and really consider their options before accepting a cash payment.
Damien, tell me about your interactions with the insurance companies post this fire. Have you had much contact with them?
Well, we've seen a range of responses. It's great that there are the recovery hubs that have been established, but we do see that some are more proactive than others. For example, this week, there was one insurance company that was on site in immediately in fire impacted communities. And in one example was about to provide a cash settlement. It seems very quick to me, but about to provide a cash settlement to one of their customers. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars and was concerned that they understood the impact that that would have on their entitlement to social security or aged care services down the track. It was great to see that they got in touch with us to make sure that particular customer was going to be connected with financial counselling and other legal advice to understand the consequences of that cash settlement. We'd love to see more of that collaborative proactivity on the part of insurers to make sure their customers understand the consequences of those decisions.
So do you think that the insurance companies are doing enough?
No, I think there's a lot more that they could do, and I think working with us to identify vulnerability of their customers, because they'll have other legal issues, to connect them with us. We're not always going to be speaking to their customers so that we can fight with the insurance companies. Of course we will when we have to, but there's going to be a range of other legal problems that arise for people who are impacted by disasters, and they're a key contact point with community members, and they can really be helping their customers by referring them to legal services and to financial counsellors. That would go a very long way to help people recover.
The community is very much in the early stages of recovery. You know that the fires just came through about a week ago. Should people be wary of offers to help to do repairs? What are some of the issues around that?
Such an unfortunate thing that we've got to be advising communities about disaster chasers and scam tradies. We know that some people very quickly turn up to disaster impacted areas and offer for fee or fee charging legal services and other services. We'd really discourage people from taking that up because there are free services that are available. Similarly, we know that when tradespeople are thin on the ground.
Hang on, let's just go back to that. When you say so there are lawyers and claim chasers, what are they and what are they offering, and what are your concerns about that?
So we have seen in previous disasters, particularly the 2022 floods, people offering to challenge insurance claims for fee for service. Now that's something that people can take up. They can always engage a private lawyers, but there's a free legal assistance sector that's there to help you. Now between private, genuine lawyers and the free legal assistance sector, we also find this group of people who purport to be something that they're not and want to charge clients for challenging decisions. And we just say don't take those up unless you're absolutely sure and you've got the means that they are an experienced and qualified lawyer in that space.
And okay, there are these claims chasers, but there are also scam tradies. Tell me about that phenomenon.
So once people are rebuilding, finding qualified tradespeople that have got the time to assist you is a real challenge. And what we know is that there's been, in previous disasters, people that have come in and promised to rebuild, taken an initial payment and then just disappeared, changed their number and certainly not done the work that they intended to do. That was particularly prevalent in areas like Rochester and Shepparton when they were rebuilding from the floods in 2022. And they're often, you know, preying on disadvantaged and disaster-impacted communities who might not, you know, have their guard up that they would have at the best of times.
Damien Stock, thank you very much for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
That's the Law Report for this week. And while we did end on that note of caution, I want to stress that I came away from my visit to Castlemaine really impressed by the care and support people are giving to their friends and neighbours. It's amazing to see communities rally around those in need. Do follow the Law Report on the ABC Listen app. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. And a big thanks to producer this week, Rachel Bongiorno, and also to audio producer this week, Kerry Dell. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.